Thank you. Yes, after that rather enigmatic comment from Andy, we had a bit of a puncture in the fast lane yesterday and had to get retired. So hopefully that's a sign that this will be a new season of rest that we're entering into. Times and seasons. They say you can tell when Christmas is approaching because Easter eggs are beginning to appear in the shops. I watch very little TV, but I had 9 kilos of crab apples to peel the other day, so I switched it on just more really for some background entertainment. And there seemed to be a lot of emphasis on the new series of Strictly Come Dancing approaching this weekend. A sure sign that the longer evenings are fast approaching, and the final will be broadcast just 1 week before Christmas, so the countdown has begun. Now, we may get excited about the stars on TV, but for thousands of years, our forefathers have looked to the heavens to understand the times and seasons. Until relatively recently, like the past 2,000 years or so, everything revolved around the appearance of the new moon. A new moon was proclaimed once it appeared, and since it meant an extra day of rest and celebration, there was a lot of excitement and anticipation as the 27th, the 28th, or the 29th day approached. A shout would go out from the Sanhedrin to proclaim that two witness accounts had confirmed a positive sighting of the new moon. So fires would be lit on mountaintops to spread the good news that a new month had begun. Many of us are probably fairly unenlightened when it comes to recognizing the signs in the sky. I certainly am. Friday morning, I was looking out the window at around 6 o'clock, and there was a beautiful thin crescent moon glowing in the darkness. Immediately, I assumed it was the beginning of a new moon, so I did some serious research. In other words, I Googled the moon times on the internet and discovered it was actually the waning or the disappearing of the old moon. We have so many gadgets and mapping apps on our mobile phones to direct us, but there actually came a strange comfort in discovering that the waning moon, which I was seeing, always points towards the east. Now, we probably don't think very much about how our calendar came into being, but I just want to very quickly give a bit of an overview, as it will hopefully help us to understand some biblical verses more clearly, which we'll be looking at shortly. So the word month, it's derived from the Latin word for moon, though there were, of course, many moons before the Roman Empire came along. If we look back as far as we are able, then we can see that in Exodus chapter 12, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron when they were still living in captivity in Egypt. Moses and Aaron had been attempting to secure the release of the Israelites, and despite the plagues of blood, the plague of frogs, the plague of gnats, the flies, the livestock, the boils, locusts, and finally darkness, Pharaoh was still refusing to let God's people go. As we well know, the 10th plague would culminate in the death of the firstborn. But God had a better plan for his own people. The death angel would pass over the homes of every family which obeyed the very specific instructions given to Moses, which we now find recorded in the book of Exodus chapter 12. Verse 1, now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb. And that, of course, was the preparation for the Passover. The Gospel writers tell us that explicitly that Jesus had returned to Jerusalem in preparation for the Jewish Passover as the events of the crucifixion were about to unfold. So the month of Passover, when it occurs, would be to Moses, Aaron and their people the first month of the year. Indeed, Passover is regarded to be one of the most important events in the Jewish calendar, and it has been handed down from generation to generation, and our date for Easter still coincides with the Jewish calendar, since Jesus is our Passover lamb who was crucified on Passover. As we read in Exodus 12, a lamb was to be taken on the 10th day of the month and sacrificed on the 14th day of the month. Now, we don't know if God's instruction that the month of Passover was introducing a new calendar or not, but we do know that the Israelites left Egypt in 1513 BC. And the month of Passover was still considered to be the first month of the year until more than 800 years later, when Numa Pompilius, the second king of Rome, he was the one after Romulus, Numa Pompilius decided to establish a temple to the god Janus and reorganized the calendar months. So just to recap and make sure we're all on the same page, until maybe 2,000 years ago, the vast majority of people relied on the appearance of a new moon to signify a new month. This is what is known as a lunar calendar. A new moon can appear anything after 27.3 days or as late as 29.5 days. And we can actually say point because the new moon will actually appear during the daytime. It can be seen. So the date is not actually set in stone. The first month of the year, as instructed by God to Moses and Aaron in Exodus 12, would be the month when Passover, and as we all probably know, the date we celebrate Easter falls at the same time. It's a movable feast. It can fall between March and April. So Easter, or Passover, falls slap bang in the middle of the first month, since Moses was told sacrificial lamb should be prepared that month. First month of the year would fall around March, April time. The second month would be April, May. The third month would be May to June, and so on, usually towards the end of the month or the beginning of the following month, as we would calculate it. The Hebrews didn't actually name their months until they came back from the Babylonian captivity, which was some thousand years later. Until then, they simply referred to the months as the first month, the second month, etc. It was the same with the days of the week when you think about it. Even in Jesus' time, we read about the first day or the third day. In fact, the only day of the week to have a proper title was the Shabbat or the Sabbath, which was the seventh day. And then the first day would eventually become known as the Lord's Day. But anyway, following their return from the Babylonian captivity, the Hebrew people would start to adopt Babylonian names for their calendar months. So that's why the month of Passover is now known as the month of Nisan. And today is actually the last day of the month of Elul. We know that the Roman Empire used this very same lunar calendar system, and they even followed the instruction from Exodus 12 to consider the first month of the year to be the month when Passover took place. But the Romans came up with their own names for the months of the year. March, the first month, was named after Mars, the god of war. They ran out of ideas rather quickly, though, naming the second month April after the Latin word aprilis, which means second. May, June, July and August were all named after leaders and deity. Maia, the Greek goddess, Juno, who was wife of Jupiter. July was Julius Caesar, named after Julius Caesar, and August after the Emperor Augustus. So we can see it was like a developing calendar of names. And then we came to the seventh month, September, from Septimus, meaning seventh. October, after Octavus, the Roman word for eighth. November, after nonus, or ninth, and December, after decem, the Latin word for tenth. We don't know what the 11th and 12th months were originally called, but I would hazard a guess and say they were probably called 11th and 12th. But then along came King Numa in 700 BC, who you may remember I said earlier is accredited with establishing a temple to Janus in the city of Rome. And he decided to name the 11th month after Janus, who was a Roman god with two faces and the ability to see the future and the past. And then the final month of the year was February, after the ancient Roman festival of purification, Februa. But not only did King Numa rename the calendar, he also decreed that the 11th month, which was January, would become known as the first month of the year. And it was a breakaway from the pattern of months and seasons that God had established way back in Exodus 12. Over time, the Romans would also rename the days of the week to incorporate the sun, the moon, and a whole pantheon of their gods, from sun day and moon day to Woden's day, Thor's day, and Saturn day. Friday has nothing to do with eating fried eggs and bacon. Friday is derived from the Germanic translation of Venus day, which is Frigga's day or Friday. So determined to make his mark in history, Julius Caesar decided to take a look at the bigger picture and introduced a solar calendar based upon the position of the sun in relation to the stars, rather than the lunar calendar, which was based upon the cycles of the moon. For want of a better name, he decided to call it the Julian calendar. It was a huge undertaking and required some incredible calculations, and indeed his statisticians and astronomers did an admirable job. However, they were approximately 11 minutes out in a year. 11 minutes may sound minor in the grand scheme of things, but 11 minutes per day over a couple of thousand years can certainly add up. By 1582 AD, which is 1582 plus 45, because Julius Caesar made his decree and changed the Julian calendar before he died in 44 BC, is 1,627 multiplied by 11 minutes is 17,897 minutes, or almost 300 hours, which is just under 12 and a half days. Why 1592 AD? 1592 is significant because that was the year when Pope Gregory the 13th established the Gregorian calendar. Pope Gregory had realized that the Jewish Passover and other important events were falling more and more out of sync with the seasons because of the Julian calendar and Julius Caesar's 11-minute discrepancy. So what did Pope Gregory the 13th do to rectify it? He deducted 12 days from September, and there was public uproar. It is reputed that the Pope's decree to deduct 12 days caused riots in London as Westminster advanced the calendar overnight from the 2nd of September to the 14th of September, and many believed it to be a papal plot. Why have I spent so much time trying to explain how our calendar evolved? I believe it's important to realise the significance of the times and seasons of God. And it maybe seems a little bit archaic for Israel to persist in holding on to their original lunar-based calendar. What difference does it even make to us now whether January or March is the beginning of the year? Admittedly, it would create havoc if we suddenly decided to revert back to the old system. But in understanding how the two systems operate side by side, we can begin to appreciate biblical dates better and uncover some ancient truths that are still very relevant to us today, since we've been grafted into the vine. There are two very significant dates in the Jewish calendar, and they are both highlighted in Leviticus chapter 23. I'm going to read Leviticus 23 and the fourth and fifth verses. These are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at their appointed times. On the 14th of the first month at twilight is the Lord's Passover. And then we have another major event recorded in Leviticus 23 verse 24, the Feast of Trumpets, which occurs in the autumn time, tomorrow to be precise. Leviticus 24, speak to the children of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, you shall have a Sabbath rest, a memorial of blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation. And in case you were thinking, that's just for the Jews, I want to read Leviticus 23, verse 2. These are my appointed feasts, the appointed feasts of the Lord, which you are to proclaim as sacred assemblies. And as we know, God doesn't change. He is the same yesterday, today and forever. Yom Teruah, or the Feast of Trumpets, is more commonly referred to as Rosh Hashanah, or the head of the year. And because it's based upon the lunar months, it's a movable feast, not a set date within our calendar. In fact, in 2021, the Feast of Trumpets began on the 6th of September, which was the first day of the month of Tishrei. This year, 2022, the month of Tishrei will begin at sunset tonight and continue for 2 days until nightfall on Tuesday, the 27th of September. While we use the year 1 AD as the focal point for world history, and we've now reached 2,022 years since that date, the Hebrew calendar is traced right back for 5,783 years to the creation of Adam and Eve. It's an interesting exercise to work your way through the genealogies of Adam and his sons and their sons to calculate the number of years since the creation of Adam's line. And I know that evolution can be a very contentious subject, and scientists are continually coming up with new theories which cannot be proven one way or another. And everyone has a view to some extent. But what I am saying is that the Hebrew calendar is much older than our current system. And while we are familiar with 2022, the Hebrew calendar is just about to begin the year 5783. Why am I saying this? Well, today is the last day of the current year, 5782. 5782 is perfectly divisible by seven. Every seventh year in the Jewish calendar is a sabbatical year, or a Shemitah, meaning release. During Shemitah, the land is left to lie fallow and all agricultural work such as ploughing, planting seed, pruning and harvesting is forbidden. And today is the last day of that year. Why release? I'm pleased you asked that question. If you were a Jew living in contemporary Israel and you owed someone a sum of money, that debt will be revoked at nightfall this evening and you will no longer be held accountable to repay that debt. Even if you wanted to repay the debt and offered to pay the money back, the lender is not permitted to accept the repayment unless he or she first reminds you that the debt actually has been written off. So while we may not see the benefits of a Shemitah today, if you are considering buying a house, it might be worth going to a Jewish mortgage provider, and in 7 years' time, you could find that your mortgage has been cleared. So the Feast of Trumpets, what does it entail? As I've said, the feast is listed in Leviticus 23, verses 24 and 25. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, in the seventh month," that's the month of Tishrei, meaning beginning in Babylonian, "on the first day of the month, which is tomorrow, you shall observe a solemn rest, a memorial proclaimed with blasting of trumpets, a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work, and you shall present a food offering to the Lord." A blast of trumpets, the Feast of Trumpets. We witnessed heralds with their long trumpets announcing the accession of King Charles III at St. James's Palace less than a fortnight ago, so the imagery is probably still very fresh in our minds. Yom Teruah is actually Hebrew for a day of shouting, a call to war, a shout of joy. We know from history that the bugle or the trumpet was blasted to rouse the troops during the American Civil War. But to the Hebrew nation, the blast of a trumpet or the sound of a shofar was also probably more significantly a call to repentance. Church bells are probably the closest thing I can think of to compare with the sound of a shofar. Over the centuries, bells have rung out to announce the death of a monarch, an emergency or attack on a village, or to announce the joyful news that a wedding is about to take place, or simply to remind members of the parish that it's time to assemble together as God's people on a Sunday morning. So following hot on the heels of the Feast of Trumpets is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, which this year will be celebrated on Wednesday, the 5th of October, so Wednesday week. Rosh Hashanah being the first of the 10 days of awe, a period of fasting, praying and repentance. The number 10, the blast of trumpets or shofars. The clues were all there. The Torah is full of imagery, and any self-respecting Jew would have known without any shadow of a doubt that the instructions were a reminder of events at Mount Sinai, when the Lord summoned Moses and the people to be a special treasure, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. Maybe the number 10 was a clue to you of the commandments, but do you remember the trumpet sounding? I'm going to read to you Exodus chapter 19, verse 13, and then verses 16 to 19. "When the trumpet sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain. On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. Then the Ten Commandments were delivered. God manifested his presence with the sound of a trumpet that caused the people to tremble." While the events of the first Passover, when the death angel passed over every lintel and doorpost in Egypt that had been daubed with the blood of a firstborn lamb, they are inextricably linked to the Passover feast. The Feast of Trumpets has become a civil new year, or Rosh Hashanah, beginning of the year, head of the year, commemorating the special place of significance Israel would hold as God's chosen people, his special treasure, his nation of priests. As the shofar will be blown tomorrow morning and Tuesday morning, which are day one and day two of Rosh Hashanah, the Jews proclaim God as King of the universe as he sits in judgment of the world and its inhabitants. it's not as if God needs to actually go through a special annual coronation ceremony, for he is high and above all. But the sound of trumpets and shofars is a reminder that we are in the presence of Almighty God, and the blast is a fitting way to announce his presence. The blowing of the shofar was also symbolic of events in Genesis 22, when God supplied a ram for Abraham to sacrifice in place of his firstborn son Isaac. The command in Leviticus to blow the shofar on the first day of the seventh month, but in actual fact the shofar would have been blown virtually every morning throughout the past month of Elul as a foretaste and a preparation for the actual Feast of Trumpets. I say virtually every morning. This is just one of those little interesting facts that you come across. This morning, the shofar will not have been blown for two reasons. Namely, if the shofar is blown every morning for the past month, then it can become more of a habit than a direct response to a command to actually blow the trumpet on the first of the month. Secondly, Satan is known as the accuser, and the rationale goes that by deliberately choosing to not sound the shofar on the morning before Rosh Hashanah begins, we will actually intimidate him. When Satan sees that God's people are so confident that they will be victorious on the day of judgment, Yom Kippur, that they don't even find it necessary to sound the shofar today, he is utterly confounded and loses confidence in his carefully prepared case against God's people. So just as the events at Mount Sinai were stamped indelibly in the memory of the nation of Israel, the Feast of Trumpets, the sound of the shofar, the very same word used in Exodus chapter 20, verse 18, reminded Israel that they were a people under covenant, a people which had accepted the responsibilities of being God's special people. Being in covenant with God included repenting of sin, which was actually a form of breaking the covenant, and then seeking atonement. We've looked with quite some detail at how the Hebrew lunar calendar and our Gregorian solar calendar have developed, and it is a useful analogy to look now at the phrase which we often hear spoken, an appointed time or an appointed season. I've done pretty well today getting this far without wandering off down a rabbit hole of Hebrew words. Yes. The Hebrew word which most of the Bible translators interpret as an appointed time, a place, an appointed place, an appointed meeting, is moad. That's spelt M-O-apostrophe-A-D. And if you're familiar with Strong's Concordance, then you'll find it listed as H for Hebrew, 4150. Moad is an interesting word. It's derived from the root word ya'ad, which is the word meaning to do something properly or appropriately, to make an appointment. Idea being, if you do something properly, then you make an appointment to make sure it happens. You put it on your calendar. In other words, you deliberately plan to do something in order to ensure that it will happen. Ya'ad is a primitive root word. And with all primitive root words, we can actually see the meaning behind. The DNA is spelt out with its root letters. And this particular word is spelt with two root letters, which makes it a little bit simpler. The two root letters being Ayin and Daleth. Excuse me. Sorry about that. The letter Ayin, I actually have one here to show you. Ayin is a pictograph of an eye. It's like two eyes on a face coming downwards. And the second letter is Daleth, which is a D. And the Daleth symbolises a doorway or an opening. Combined, Aleth, Ayin, Daleth, the two-letter hieroglyphic means see the door, look for the door, as if coming into a tent or a tent of meeting or a tabernacle and entering in to meet. You see the connections with the idea of setting things in a calendar or making appointments to come together and meet. So Moses and Aaron and Joshua did not simply enter the tabernacle of tent of meeting as a one-off appointment or just whenever they thought they felt like doing it. Ya'ad is used as a verb meaning to repeat an action, as in a daily encounter in God's appointment book. And the verb also carries the more abstract idea of being a witness. So a moad is not simply a one-off appointment time or place in the sense of the phrase for such a time as this. This appointment time and this appointed place refer to a place, time and event that are to be repeated over and over again. And as we learn to see the door and to watch for the openings into the tent, we will find that we will have encounters. We will witness events that others would never dare encounter, and we will bear witness to these encounters. I don't want to get on my hobby horse, but I will. Hebrew was spoken long before the Greek and Roman empires were established. It's not as if no one spoke until the Roman Empire began to take occupation. I love watching programs like Countdown because I've always held a fascination for words and their origins. Take the word lexicographer. It comes from the word lex or lexicon, meaning words, and grapha, which is to write. So a lexicographer is someone who writes and compiles dictionaries. It has become traditional for lexicographers to attribute most of our dictionaries to either Latin or Greek origin, as these are subjects we're more familiar with since they're taught in some of our schools. Latin was actually still compulsory when I was at school. And while I got 3% in my first Latin exam, I actually went on to study it to O level, and then I studied Greek and Hebrew at university. So it did instill something in me. But there have been huge advancements in our understanding of Hebrew root words in recent years, mainly due to resources available on the internet. So it may only be a matter of time before we start to see dictionaries rewritten to show the Hebrew root word rather than simply the Latin or Greek, which weren't so much new or original languages as a consolidation of what was already being spoken. So take this root word ya'ad, or ayin daleth, eyes on the door, see the door. The Latin preposition ad, meaning to, towards, or near, is still a commonly used prefix and suffix to many of our English words like advance and adverbs, which mean point towards a verb. So basically, ad comes from ya'ad. Back to the Hebrew calendar. Assuming that I haven't confused you altogether, there are two new years in the Hebrew calendar. The religious new year, which was decreed by Jehovah God in Exodus 12, naming the month when Passover or Easter takes place as the first month of the year, and then the seventh month of the Hebrew calendar when the Feast of Trumpets is celebrated, which is more a civil new year since the phrase Rosh Hashanah means head of the year and isn't actually found in the Old Testament. It's maybe not that strange an idea to us really though. Because when you think about it, from the small Pacific islands of Tonga, Samoa and Kiribati, to Baker Island, which is midway between Hawaii and Australia, the world celebrates New Year on the 1st of January. And then we have a financial or a fiscal New Year at the start of April, when businesses begin a new tax year. And then schools and colleges begin their New Year in the autumn time. Rosh is the Hebrew word for headship, and the root word means to inherit, to shake or to nod. At first glance, you may be thinking, that sounds a bit vague, but think of the chief of a tribe or a monarch. It's more fitting for someone in their position to indicate their consent or their displeasure with a sedate nod or a shake of the head. Even a child will quickly learn to recognise the headship or the authority of a parent with the raising of an eyebrow, that look, a slight nod or shake of the head that speaks volumes. So Rosh is like the head position in a family, which is inherited by the senior member of the family and is transferred down through the generations. It may not be deemed popular or even fair in today's society, but a family wealth or land or property, the title of a duke or duchess or even HRH often needs to be passed down through the eldest child in order for the estate to continue. A house divided will fall. A will where a house is broken up into four or five pieces, there will be very little to show for it in a few years' time. But there's some things which are inherited by every member of the family. DNA is passed from generation to generation. The word tells us that blessings and curses can be passed down. Blessings to 1,000 generations, curses to three generations. Blessings have far more power in them to be passed down. I think that's something we often overlook. A recent study of Holocaust survivors, though, showed that trauma was passed on to their children via their genes. That's quite sad. While Rosh Hashanah may not be a biblical name for the Feast of Trumpets, Hashanah is the Hebrew word for the year. So Rosh is head, and Hashanah, ha meaning the, Shana is the year. I love exploring the Hebrew way of thinking as it's so rich in meaning. Take, for example, the way we think about years. We think of years as the sum total of a period of time. We talk about something that happened so many years ago, or when we ask someone their age, the reply is X number of years. But in Hebraic thought, a year is not measured as a length of time. A year is the revolution of time. It's a circular rather than linear thought. It's repeating rather than extending. In Hebrew thought, time revolves, seasons repeat, each year runs its course, and then the next year replaces it. As the Feast of Trumpets reminds us of the calling at Mount Sinai for God's people to be a royal priesthood, a holy nation belonging to God, Rosh Hashanah is a time to evaluate our position, to remind ourselves that we should be rising into the authority we have inherited as sons of the Most High and moving in the strength of our calling. You may be thinking, no, we aren't Jewish. We don't have that heritage. But we have been grafted into the vine. And as Paul wrote in 1 Peter 2, verse 9, but you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. Verse 10, once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. It would be remiss of me to ignore a couple of traditions now associated with the Rosh Hashanah celebrations. Part of the weekly Shabbat meal throughout the year will usually include a braided loaf of bread known as challah bread. A good friend of mine who is an Israeli brought us some challah bread from Jerusalem. The ch is like the ch at the end of Bach. It's a guttural sound, challah bread. But you can just call it challah bread, it's easier. And it was a fairly substantial loaf. This sort of length. Certainly you'd get a few meals out of it, or a family would probably be well fed on it. But the challah bread enjoyed at Rosh Hashanah is a round loaf. It is perfectly round and it is studded with sweet raisins and dipped in either honey or sugar. It's eaten alongside apples that are also dipped in honey. Honey is added and sour or tart foods are avoided at this time of year to symbolise hope for a sweet and pleasant year ahead. So even if you love blackcurrants or lemon, you wouldn't eat it over the next couple of days. The apples are not selected simply because of their sweetness, but also because they are reminiscent of paradise and the beginning of creation, a new year with new beginnings. Some say that the round challah resembles a crown, reminding us of the overarching theme of the king's coronation. The round challah has no end, symbolising and activating our wish for a year in which life and blessings continue without end. The round loaf is also known in some circles as a wheel of fortune. So just as creation was given to mankind on Rosh Hashanah, many Jews believe that they are allocated their income for the incoming year at this time. There's a renewed understanding of the fact that wealth and provision are in the hands of God. So as the bread is kneaded and proved and baked, our fortune may go up and down, but ultimately everything is in the hands of God. We might be thinking this idea is a little bit strange to us, but maybe not. A harvest is gathered at this time of year and the farmer must decide how best to manage the harvest so that he will be able to survive until the next crop is harvested. Friday past was our autumn budget day as the Chancellor of the Exchequer announced changes in tax and national insurance contributions. Students receive their grants at this time of year and they must learn to budget their resources until the next instalment is paid. Kind of makes you wonder if Hebrew roots may well have influenced our culture over several thousand years. So it is customary for Rosh Hashanah challahs to be studded with sweet raisins, which are made from grapes. And the Jewish people are compared to grapes in the Talmud. And the round challah is reminiscent of the world. So it's as if Jews will be throughout the entire world. The word challah means hollow or to have holes in it. So many of our primitive English words are derived from the Hebrew. Challah, hollow. Chal was actually an early form of bow drill used to bore holes. The string of the bow was wrapped around the drill or a sharp stick into the ground. And it was, if you think of like a coat hanger, and instead of the long bit of the coat hanger that comes down, if it was a piece of rope and caught in that is a pole coming down. As the bow is moved backwards and forwards, the way a musician would slide the bow back and forth across a violin or cello, it drills a hole in the ground. You can actually still buy bow drills on various online sites to this day, as they're more commonly used to light fires on camping trips if you don't want to resort to matches and firelighters. But how is the bread perforated with holes? It's not like a massive crumpet or a ball of Swiss cheese. It doesn't have holes drilled into it. It's not like a rich fruitcake that your maid and aunt might have injected with sherry or prodded with a knitting needle to ensure that the alcohol pervaded the entire cake in time for Christmas. I think this is a very interesting point. The holes were probably due to the fact that there was yeast in the bread. It was leavened bread, not unleavened. The holes appeared as the yeast was activated. And so often in Hebrew thought, yeast was kind of typified with sin. So it was common. It wasn't holy. It wasn't set apart. Yet the challah bread or the challah cake was actually used as an offering. It was acceptable to be used as an offering. And I think there's something really earth that's grounded in the fact that even what we have to offer, which is not perfect, is still acceptable as an offering before the throne room. I mentioned that the challah eaten at Rosh Hashanah is different because it's round rather than a loaf. The more traditional braided loaf is made by taking small round balls of dough and rolling them into long thin strands and then braiding them in and out to make a long loaf. The traditional challah represents unity and demonstrates how separate strands are twisted together to form a perfect whole, just as the Israelites received the Torah at Mount Sinai and they were like one man with one heart. But the round challah eaten at Rosh Hashanah is different to the weekly challah eaten on the Sabbath. For Rosh Hashanah is a time for soul searching for the individual. It's personal. It's not woven together with different strands. It is simply one large ball of dough. So does this apply to us, or is it just for Israel? Did Jehovah just provide a lamb for Abraham? Did Jehovah just free the Israelites from bondage in Egypt? Were the million-strong band who grumbled and complained their way throughout the wilderness and who built a mighty golden calf while Moses was receiving the Ten Commandments up Mount Sinai, were they the only ones that God would call to be his treasured possession, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation? A new season is almost upon us. The shofar will soon be sounded and the call will be heard to rise up, to get ready, to get back into line, to examine ourselves and our motives, to be as one with those who are leaning in to hear the word of the Lord, to rise up, stand shoulder to shoulder with and see the kingdom of heaven advance on heaven, heaven advance on earth as it is in heaven. Let all of creation see that the King of Kings, is on his throne. The question is not so much about whether this is just for one individual people group or whether Israel have fulfilled their destiny. It's more about a loving, gracious, patient Heavenly Father who created man in his own image, who persistently calls his people to turn back into right relationship. It's less about focusing on the sin cycle of a nation who fell away from its calling time and time again in the book of Judges. It's more about standing in awe, captivated by an almighty creator God who would be eternally committed to keeping his covenant, redeeming, forgiving, compassionate, holy. A God who never changes, a God who chose the nation of Israel to be a walking, talking, living example of how he faithfully loves and blesses. From the beginning of creation, when Adam walked with God in the Garden of Eden, to the miraculous provision of a sacrificial ram, to the call at Mount Sinai to be a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. We don't stand in judgment of Israel. We don't stand in judgment of anyone. We simply kneel in awe of the one who calls us to be his bride, his chosen, and we simply follow. Amen.